You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards. This summer, Cuba saw some of its largest anti-government protests in decades, perhaps since the revolution itself. The protests broke out across most of the country at the same time, apparently because they were spreading over social media. They were stoked by massive stress, including food and economic shortages. They combined a lot of different sectors of society with a lot of different grievances, and they were followed by a crackdown. Dozens of arrests, Amnesty International has a list of about 150, and large pro-government protests the following weekend. Now, even Cuba's president, Miguel Díaz-Canel Bermúdez, has acknowledged that at least a subset of the protesters have legitimate grievances that it's the government's job to try to address. Most of the media attention in this country has been focused on what the Biden administration will do. We thought we should spend some time on what Cuba's doing about Cuba. So we have invited on Aviva Chomsky, professor of history and coordinator of Latin American studies at Salem State University in Massachusetts. Her many books include A History of the Cuban Revolution. Aviva Chomsky, welcome back on the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. I guess I wanted to start to kind of get your sense of the protests. What do we know about like what sectors of society were turning out against the government?
Well, some of the recent events, developments that have been happening in Cuba have been extremely hard on the poorer sectors of Cuba's population. And in particular, there were three big demands being made by the protesters. One is about access to food. A second is about access to electricity. And the third is about access to vaccines. Now, Cuba has been struggling with various levels of economic crisis really ever since 1989, 1991, with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the loss of the economic system that they had really built up since the 1960s that was heavily dependent on trade and aid with the socialist bloc, since they were completely cut out of the U.S. markets that had traditionally been kind of the sustenance of Cuba's economy. So the collapse at the beginning of the 1990s necessitated or brought about a lot of changes and reforms. And I mean, I should say, when you look at the economic history of Cuba since the revolution, it's been a constant process of experimentation, change, reform. It's not like there was one economic model, one economic system that was the case constantly. But the state-controlled economy and the absence of a private sector was very much by the 1980s, the way things were, although there were some experiments even in the 1980s with openings to a private sector, and especially in agriculture and farmers markets, but those were again closed. So the changes since the 1990s have generally been sort of a desperate struggle to obtain foreign exchange through different kinds of openings to the private sector, through trying to attract foreign investment, through trying to bring in tourism, and through allowing different types of self-employment and small businesses. And the state sector has really, that so many Cubans have depended on for so long, has really suffered from the austerity, the lack of foreign exchange, and the lack of ability to provide the goods and services that Cubans had come to expect.
We should clarify, when you say foreign exchange, we're talking about literal foreign currency, like dollars and euros in government accounts.
That can be used to buy things on international markets. So Cuba's economy is heavily dependent on imports. It's heavily petroleum dependent. The ability to import petroleum. Now, Venezuela stepped in for about a decade to try to make up for some of the losses, especially in petroleum, but that's over now, as we know. Lack of energy has really plagued Cuba's economy since the collapse of the socialist bloc. And much of Cuba's food was imported. Cuba has tried over and over again since the 1960s to develop some different kinds of food sovereignty. But by the 1970s, they had sort of developed this relationship where instead of struggling for food sovereignty, they were going to produce sugar for the socialist bloc. You know, the first time I went to Cuba was in 1995, as Cuba was just beginning to figure out how to emerge from the crisis caused by the fall of the socialist bloc. And, you know, a lot of the complaints, obviously not vaccines, but lack of food, lack of electricity was plaguing the island then too. And that's one of the reasons that we saw protests in 1994 and the huge wave of emigrants in 1994. Lack of food, lack of electricity. Especially these things happen in the summer because it's extremely hot in Cuban summers. Most people don't even have air conditioners, but at least access to fans. Cuban energy use goes way up in the summer. And if you can't even turn on a fan in the kind of stagnant heat you get there, it's just close to unbearable.
Well, how would you compare what Cuba is enduring right now to that period, the so-called special period after the collapse of the Soviet Union?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it's similar, except that all of the economic reforms since the 1990s have really entrenched a lot of social and racial inequalities. So that's where I was going with that long commentary I started, because you had asked which sectors of Cuban society. The openings to private enterprise and to dollarization and to foreign investment and to tourism really started to reproduce some of the kinds of pre-revolutionary privilege that had existed in Cuba. That is, some people had access to remittances from relatives in Miami who were earning in dollars. Some people didn't. Some people had access to the tourist sector. Some people didn't. The social and racial inequalities that the 1959 revolution tried so hard to overcome started to rear their ugly heads again, because Cubans who had come from former wealth and who were whiter were more likely to have relatives abroad who were earning money that they could send back to them. They were more likely, for a whole variety of reasons, to be able to take advantage of the tourist sector, and they were the ones who suffered the most from the deterioration of the ability of the state to provide services. So the emergence of this private economy starts to create privileged classes again. So those who were protesting tended to be more poor, more Black, than the Cubans in Miami who claimed to be supporting the protesters. But, you know, you use the term anti-government protesters. And, you know, we have to be careful about what we think that means when we talk about it in the United States and we talk about Cuba. Like, when we talk about Black Lives Matter protests in the United States, we don't usually call them anti-government protests. Yes, they're protesting the government, but anti-government protests suggests that they're trying to overthrow the government. Mm. And we certainly heard plenty of that from Miami. But among Cubans in Cuba, the demand wasn't that the government be replaced. The demand was that the government change, that the government address their demands. And those had mostly to do with food, electricity, and vaccines.
That's interesting. I've been to Cuba a couple times this century. And you get a Cuban in private, it's pretty easy to turn up like an exhaustive list of small complaints they have with how things are run. And every time I've gotten involved in one of those conversations, they usually wind up caveating it with, but we don't want what you have in the United States. I like getting healthcare.
And, you know, in other countries, we understand that people protest and they have specific demands in their protests. But I think it's part of the like anti-Cuban propaganda that we are so inundated with here that makes us think, oh, anti-government protesters, they want to overthrow the government. And certainly Cubans in Cuba do not want a U.S. intervention, as many Cubans in Miami are calling for. And one of my Cuban friends who is currently in Miami said, you know, what are they talking about? My son is in Cuba. My granddaughter is in Cuba. They want an invasion? They want to kill my family?
Well, so then what? Protesters who are making demands of the government, not demands to replace the government, to the extent they have a coherent vision, what is it? What do they want done?
I'm not sure everyone who was protesting actually has a coherent vision of what they want done. They're suffering from really desperate conditions, and they're protesting those conditions. And certainly the United States is doing everything it can to exacerbate those conditions. you know, not just the legislation that was passed, the punitive legislation that was passed in the 1990s, like the Torricelli Law at the beginning of the 90s, the Helms-Burton Law in the middle of the 1990s, where Congress stepped in to strengthen the U.S. embargo on Cuba, to turn it into what Cubans call a blockade by enforcing, requiring it to be enforced extraterritorially. That is, that the United States is required to punish other countries and other businesses that do business with Cuba, and enshrining it into law so that the president can massage it but can't remove the blockade. So in order to remove the blockade now, that has to go through Congress. And we all know how likely getting anything through Congress is now. But the Trump administration strengthened the blockade in numerous ways that the Biden administration could actually change. And when Biden campaigned, he promised to go back to the Obama era diplomatic and economic opening towards Cuba. Since he has been in office, he has reneged on that promise. And one of the ways that Cuba was bringing foreign exchange into the country was by sending Cuban doctors abroad, especially to other countries of Latin America. And in the midst of the COVID crisis, Trump started pressuring other Latin American countries to break their agreements with the Cuban government and to send Cuban doctors back home. So Brazil, El Salvador, Ecuador bent to U.S. pressure and lost a significant number of the doctors of their country who were serving the poor right in the midst of a global pandemic. This is just one of the most disgusting and egregious pieces of this. There's a couple of policies that were implemented in Cuba recently that also have been really harsh on the population. You know, Cuba was very successful during the early months of the pandemic, partly by shutting down tourism. And of course, they have developed their own vaccines. But in recent months, they have opened, especially the tourist area of Varadero. And there's been a lot of promotion of Russian tourism there. And apparently, that's one of the factors behind the dramatic spread of COVID in the island recently. And tourism is something that a lot of Cubans have a lot of really mixed feelings about. It seems to bring back the bad old days in a lot of ways, where wealthy foreigners get access to things that Cubans don't have. That causes a lot of resentment. I think a lot of Cubans understand like the government's rationale in promoting tourism, which is that the state gets its cut and that's how it's able to maintain social services. But just seeing day to day the luxuries that tourists have access to in your own country that you don't have access to is very painful. And I think it's doubly painful for Cubans who were schooled to believe that their revolution gives them the right to all of these things. And on top of that, the reopening to tourism and, you know, some of the places where COVID spread has been the worst have been in the cities around Varadero, where a lot of the people who work in tourism live. So there's definitely that connection there. The other thing that the Cuban government did at the beginning of this year that has made things extremely difficult economically is the unification of the currency. Part of the reforms of the 1990s was to allow U.S. dollars to circulate on the island so that people who could get access to dollars, either through remittances or through working for foreign enterprises that were now being allowed to pay their workers partly in dollars, or through the underground economy serving tourism, and eventually openly serving tourism as different businesses serving tourism, private small businesses began to be authorized, could use those dollars to buy imported goods that Cubans who earned their state salaries in pesos, Cuban pesos, the national money, didn't have access to. So again, this was a way of trying to bring in foreign exchange to support the social safety net that the government provides, but it creates this privileged class and a lot of resentment by people who don't have access to these things.
Also some brain drain, right? I mean, what I recall, the currency that was pegged to the dollar, the peso convertible, that was driving like a lot of PhDs to drive cabs because the dollarized currency was what was in circulation in the tourist economy.
Yes. And we call it a domestic brain drain, because usually brain drain refers to people leaving the country to get access to dollars and luxuries in a country where they can earn more money. But this was kind of an internal or a domestic brain drain, where people are leaving the state sector, where they were working at socially useful jobs, like being doctors and teachers and things like that, and moving into the tourist economy, or, you know, some relationship which tended to be a kind of a servile relationship, again, reproducing pre-revolutionary Cuba, but getting access to a lot more money that way. The CUC was actually introduced a little bit later, so I was getting to that. But another way that the Cuban government then tried to take more control of the dollar economy was by creating this new currency, the CUC, the convertible peso, so that instead of spending dollars, Cubans had to change them into Cuban convertible pesos at a one-to-one rate, but, you know, paying a commission, as you always do when you exchange money. After the CUC was introduced, Cuba was operating with two separate exchange rates, one for businesses and one for individuals. And this caused all kinds of economic complexities and distortions. So unifying the currency was something that the government has been, that Cuban economists have been asking for, and that the government has been working towards for years now. And a lot of Cuba's best minds and economists have been saying it's going to be painful, but it has to happen. But it happened in kind of the worst moment. I mean, it didn't happen. The government chose to implement it in kind of the worst moment at the beginning of this year, you know, probably thinking that they had COVID somewhat under control, but they really didn't, as we can see now. I mean, nobody does. This isn't unique to Cuba. Every country goes through, has seems like it's gone through a moment of thinking, oh, we have it under control, and then seeing, oh, actually, we didn't have it under control. Just look at the Olympics in Japan. So unifying the currency, which they did, I believe it was in January or the beginning of February, basically meant that people's pesos lost their value and there was a huge inflation. So that has actually been a major factor contributing to the economic pain that people are feeling. Now, does anybody have a better solution? You know, I'm not an economist, but I've read a lot of Cuban economists and economists outside of Cuba, left and right. And, you know, the consensus that this had to be done is pretty universal. But could it perhaps have been done less painfully? I don't know. I can't really answer that question. But every third world country is suffering from economic crisis and from pandemic crisis right now. So, you know, a lot of the decision-making power in the global economy really rests in the wealthy countries. So is there anything better that India should have done or Iraq should be doing or Indonesia should be doing? Well, yes, in some ways, there's certainly things that they could have done better and should be doing better. And the same is true of Cuba. But, you know, why don't poor countries have vaccines? It's not because of anything poor countries have done wrong. It's because of something rich countries are doing wrong. And in the case of Cuba, it's even more exaggerated because they have vaccines. They have made their own vaccines. And this is, you know, kind of a testament to how well the socialized sector actually has worked. But they haven't been able to get access to raw materials because they don't have foreign exchange. They haven't been able to get access to syringes. So in the case of many other third world countries, we could say, well, you know, the rich countries need to stop hoarding vaccines and give them vaccines. In the case of Cuba, it's that the United States has to stop making it impossible for other countries to trade with and aid Cuba.
But it also sounds like you're describing a real damned if you do, damned if you don't situation, right? If the U.S. restrictions ease, if suddenly there's the trade and the tourism and the remittances coming in, you heighten the inequalities you were describing that contribute to the unrest. When Cuba operates in isolation, it's more equal, but more equal in the context of there being mass shortages of essential goods.
Well, there's a couple of different things here. But before I get to that economic part, and I noted it down, so I'll get back to it. There's one area where the protesters are making demands, where they are really clear in what they want the Cuban government to do, and where the Cuban government really can make some changes. And that has to do with, you know, I almost hate to use the terminology that people use in the United States, because I think it really loses something in the translation. But I'll try to explain it. That is, the Cuban government reacts extremely closed-mindedly and defensively to any kind of protest in Cuba. And, you know, Cubans are really tired of being told, oh, it's just the enemy of the North, it's just the blockade, of being called out into the street to show their support for the revolution. That's just gotten really old for Cubans. And there's no need for the Cuban government to do that. The Cuban government could allow a much more participatory, transparent kind of politics. And I'm not saying that the Cuban government needs to destroy itself, needs to step down, but within the system of Cuba, there is room, and there have been moments during the history of the revolution when there has been more and less room for open debate about policies and the direction of Cuba and the people's right to differ in their opinions publicly in the political sphere. So I think that people are demanding that. And the problem is that anything that hints of demands towards more political freedoms is immediately suspected of being fomented by the United States and answering not to the desires of Cubans for more political freedoms within the system that they have, but being either funded or manipulated or created by the United States as a way of trying to overthrow Cuba's government. So we all know how defensively the US government has responded when we think other countries are trying to interfere with our elections or our politics. No country likes that. But I don't think that the Cuban government is helping its position with the Cuban people by its sort of defensive and closed response to every sign of discontent or protest. I think there's a lot more room in Cuba for loyal opposition, and that the Cuban government should make space for that. And I think that's one of the demands that people in the streets are making, especially, you know, one of the things that has fed into this most recent protest movement is the longer standing ongoing protests of Cuban artists for more freedom of expression. Again, it's also true that the United States is trying to fund and manipulate this as an openly stated part of the larger U.S. policy of trying to overthrow Cuba's government. Obviously, the United States should stop doing that, but the Cuban government doesn't need to respond so reflexively because that's what the United States is doing either.
It's funny, early in the conversation, you kind of gently corrected my framing of people in the streets with complaints about their circumstances as automatically being an anti-government protest. That's the widespread framing in the U.S. media. It sounds like you're saying the Cuban government is kind of guilty of the same reflexive framing.
Yes, yes, I do think so. In the days after the protests first happened on July 11th, I was just getting so frustrated reading the news and the analysis. It's like, you know, kind of reflexively anti-Cuban government or reflexively pro-Cuban government. You know, I'm exaggerating with the no, but what I read in the first day or two fell into this sort of exaggerated mirror images that just reinforce each other rather than analysis of what's actually going on. But you mentioned another really important issue, which is that wouldn't lessening the blockade also bring problems for Cuba? So I talked about remittances and how remittances certainly helped some people more than other people and created more inequalities. That's true.
Remittances is Cubans living abroad sending money back to family.
Yes. And this is actually true. You know, immigrants from everywhere in Latin America, from everywhere in the third world, send home remittances. It's a huge part of the global economy, and the economies of pretty much every poor country is remittances sent back to families. Those remittances are also very important to the economic survival of individuals and of countries, because the remittances can be taxed, can be, you know, commissions taken. And in Cuba, when dollars are spent, the government is taking a cut. So, you know, both are true. All of these kinds of economic openings, whether it's self-employment, small businesses, they create inequalities. That's what capitalism does. But it also creates goods. And the Cuban government has attempted to sort of manage this by the way that it taxes and takes from the foreign sector to support the state sector. Has it always been successful? Yes, no, kind of, sort of, sometimes. But I'm not sure that there's a better way that a poor country can survive in this global economy.
So I know, like, circumstances make it very easy for the Cuban government to slip into a siege mentality when it's confronted with internal criticism. But I'd kind of like to talk for a moment about the ideal of the Cuban political system and how it's supposed to handle, or how at least conceives of itself handling, dissent and criticism, because it's different from what we have. There's a famous Fidel Castro quote, within the revolution, everything, against the revolution, nothing. It's been translated a couple different ways. Could you kind of explain the concept, kind of the Platonic ideal of how Cuba's political system handles dissent?
You know, I'm not really sure it's that different from the way any other country handles dissent, because no country allows armed resistance that is attempting to overthrow the government. And most countries don't even allow unarmed resistance that's trying to overthrow the government. You know, we have words like treason. No government allows itself to be overthrown. We have seen in this country the kinds of violence that have been brought down on individuals or movements that have actually had as their goal overthrowing the government. So, you know, when Fidel Castro, you know, those words have been repeated so many times and interpreted in many different ways, because who gets to decide what is within the revolution and what is against the revolution? I mean, the revolution is the government. So, you know, anti-government activities like protest is allowed in liberal democracies, but overthrowing the government is not allowed. And we have to add to this the role of the United States. Like right now, China is our biggest official enemy, right? So look at how people in the United States who are being accused of working with the Chinese government or working for Chinese institutions, like in completely irrational ways, academics being targeted for, you know, working with a Chinese research institution in the kind of academic collaboration that we always do with people in other countries. But suddenly, because China is the big enemy, even though China poses no threat to the United States, whereas the United States poses a huge threat to Cuba. So, you know, I feel like those words, first of all, the ways that they've been understood and implemented in Cuba have varied a lot over time. There have been periods of a lot of political openness where debate and dissent was openly encouraged and allowed. And I'm thinking about just back in the mid-1990s when I worked for a time with a research institute, a government research institute called the CEA, the Centro de Estudios sobre América, the Center for American Studies, where a lot of intellectuals who were really kind of pushing the bounds of what was allowed, but they were encouraged to do that. That is, the government was really encouraging sociologists and economists to think about, okay, what can Cuba do now? And then in 1995, suddenly somebody somewhere up in the bureaucracy decided that the people working at CEA had gone too far. And, you know, what happened to CEA also shows in a way how, you know, we talk about repression and we imagine people like being taken from their houses in the middle of the night and disappearing. That's not how repression worked in Cuba. The way repression worked was that the director of CEA was fired and was replaced by a kind of a hardline party man. And bit by bit, CEA's activities were kind of reoriented and many of the researchers left CEA. And so the group of CEA no longer existed. And it was a really dynamic and academically and politically exciting place to be. So that group didn't exist anymore. But the individuals found spaces in other universities and research institutions. Like nobody was arrested, nobody was tortured, nobody was disappeared, but they lost their platform. Many of them have continued to publish. Some of them left the island. Not all of them did. Some of them are still there. So, you know, one day CEA was doing what the revolution asked it to do, and the next day it was working outside. It was decided that the government didn't like what CEA was doing anymore. So that's just like one moment. But there have certainly been moments where artistic and intellectual expression, the bounds of what's within the revolution have been very broad. And there's been moments where they have really shrunk and narrowed what is allowed within the revolution.
Maybe we should back up a little bit and kind of do definitions, because I think most Americans think revolution, they think, you know, kind of time-bounded military campaign. The Cuban Revolution, the way the word revolution gets tossed around in Cuba, like, does not end in 1959 with the Battle of Santa Clara. What does revolution mean in the Cuban system?
Right. I mean, in a lot of ways, the revolution only really begins in January 1st, 1959, with because the revolution is a project of revolutionary transformation of society. So there's the military phase where the July 26th movement that led the armed revolution took power. And then there is the revolutionary process of social transformation that begins with things like the literacy campaign, the agrarian reform law, the urban reform law, the attempt to create a completely different kind of economy and society in Cuba. The huge voluntary mobilizations and the literacy campaign was just one early example of that, just asking Cubans to come out and change their country and be part of building a new country. So to really create a different kind of country in Cuba. And of course, by the middle of 1959, the United States has come to the conclusion that they don't want to let this experiment happen. And they begin the campaign of trying to overthrow it. Many people are aware of the Bay of Pigs invasion and think that it kind of began and ended there. Although how you justify the Bay of Pigs invasion, again, how would the United States justify another country deciding to invade the United States to overthrow its government, even if it failed as the Bay of Pigs invasion failed? But that was just the tip of the iceberg, because there has been basically no let up, except for a small one during the Obama years, of the U.S. attempts. Open, overt, covert, in the early years to assassinate Fidel Castro. And it's the stated goal of the blockade is to cause the collapse of the Cuban government. And I mean, I always think about what Kissinger said about Chile, you know, to make the economy scream so as to make sure that the Allende government would collapse. And that is what the United States is still trying to do with Cuba, promoting and funding opposition organizations. And opposition here, now I'm not talking about loyal opposition, I'm talking about opposition that is actually trying to overthrow the Cuban government. The United States is still openly doing that. And, you know, you look at the records of USAID and, you know, they have lots of nice words, like they call it democracy promotion. But those are basically code words. They're trying to overthrow the government, to bring down the government.
Well, I suppose the counter would be, if you are critical of how things are being run and you can't channel that through free and open elections, your mechanism of change has to be opposing the government until it either concedes to your demands or is overthrown.
So again, I think that's where we're falling into the kind of mirror image narratives where I would fault both the Cuban government and some of its more kind of blind supporters and the U.S. government of ignoring the complexity of how things work in Cuba. You know, there's only one political party in Cuba, the Communist Party, but within the Communist, in the United States, the Democratic Party runs everywhere from West Virginia's mansion to New York's Ocasio-Cortez, right? There's a lot of variety inside the Democratic Party. And I think the same thing is true within the Communist Party in Cuba. It's not a monolith. And just looking at the radical kinds of change that has gone on, that is, the change doesn't necessarily come through elections in Cuba. Change doesn't really much come through elections in the United States either. Change comes more through involvement and engagement, whether it's at the very local municipal levels, where like municipal councils are making decisions about local issues, or whether it's at the highest levels of the Communist Party where these things are being debated. So, you know, I think that there's more kind of invisible similarities in how change happens or doesn't happen, and what's allowed and what isn't allowed, and what the avenues are that get hidden when we accept this kind of black and white dichotomous either or way of looking at, oh, Cuba is communist, so that's how it is, without seeing the complexity and nuance of what's going on there and how politics works there.
The phrase you used a bit earlier in the interview was the government is the revolution. So if you're against the government, you are against the revolution outside the bounds of Cuban mm-hmm. politics. How long does the government get to, you know, keep the claim of being the steward of the revolution? There's not a Castro in office anymore.
Right.
Kind of like outlived the generation of people who overthrew the Batista dictatorship.
Well, you know, a lot of people in the United States predicted that with the stepping down of power from power by Fidel Castro, or with his death, there was going to be like a major overturn of the system in Cuba. But what happened fits a lot more with what I was just describing, is a process of gradual change from within. The system didn't collapse. There was an orderly transfer of power. And the same thing happened when Raul Castro stepped down. I really think that the system is capable of change from within and has changed dramatically from within between 1959 and today. And the argument or logic of the system is that it will continue to change from within. And, you know, many of us who protest and object to things that the government does in the United States also want to change it from within. We don't want an armed revolution in the United States to overthrow our government. As angry as we are with it, we want peaceful change from within. When do we get to end capitalism here in the United States?
It's a tall order.
You know, sure, I'd like to, but instead, I'm fighting for Medicare for all. You know, I want peaceful, gradual change from within as we get rid of capitalism. I don't want to take up arms and have society collapse.
And as you point out in the introduction to your history of the Cuban Revolution, no nation, no economy is strictly capitalist or strictly socialist. They are all mixed economies somewhere on the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, just kind of watching the headlines, when the Cuban government attributes blame for the shortages that are getting people out into the streets to U.S. sanctions and the U.S. embargo, I get that that's a valid claim. As political rhetoric, it seems to kind of strip the government of agency and strip Cuba of agency. It's like all the power over Cuban circumstances rests in the hand of their neighbor to the north.
Yeah, and that's...
Am I reading that wrong?
No. I think you're absolutely right. And that's why I was saying earlier that I think most Cubans, they know that already, and they're really tired of hearing it. They want to know, okay, that's the situation. What are you going to do about it? What are we going to do about it? We still need food. It's not enough to say, oh, the blockade. We still need food. And, you know, I think that the protests of 1994 had a lot to do. They were, in a way, a response. They were certainly a response to the economic collapse. They were also, in a way, a protest against some of the economic changes that the government had started to put into place, because people were seeing, oh, now other people are getting access to these things, but we aren't. Other people are getting access to food in dollar stores. But I think those protests also pushed the government to do things like open up free agricultural markets, like farmers markets, where farmers could sell their produce directly to the public. Cubans are not used to capitalism and inequality, and they're really resentful of it. Not everybody could buy at those farmers markets. Not everybody could buy much at those farmers markets, but they did greatly increase food supply and food availability and food accessibility. And what I've heard from people on the ground is that, you know, one of the big complaints was electricity, the electricity cuts. I believe it was in Matanzas or it was in Cardenas, I can't remember now. But the electricity has been restored since the protests. And Miguel Díaz-Canel, you know, acknowledged that there are unbearable shortages going on that the government has to do something about. So, you know, I think these are a way of, that people are making their voices heard and that the government is responding and hopefully will respond more. But, of course, it's also true that there are limits to what the government can do because of the blockade and the way the global economy functions. And, you know, Cuba is certainly not the only third world country that's seeing mass protests going on in these days. That is, the combination of COVID and the economic crises and collapses caused by COVID is really affecting many other countries besides Cuba. Most countries do not have the resources to really cushion this for their populations.
Aviva Chomsky, I think that's probably a good note to end on. I want to thank you so much. This is really helpful for me to think about how to frame the kind of scant coverage we get of what's happening inside Cuba.
Well, thank you. It is really frustrating, the coverage that that I've been reading.
Aviva Chomsky is a professor of history and coordinator of Latin American studies at Salem State University in Massachusetts. Her many books include A History of the Cuban Revolution.